The horned boy with Amanda. She was already unconscious, but he was here. And now he's out there, and if he did this, then we're all in a lot of danger. The cop looked at them for a long moment.
You two better get on home.
Did you hear me? Hazel demanded. We're in a lot of danger. Fairfold is in danger.
The policeman stepped back from the car.
I said, you better get on home.
You're not from around here, are you? She asked him. I mean, you weren't born here.
He looked back at her, uncertainty in his face for the first time. Then his eyes hardened, and he waved them on.
At least tell me if Amanda's okay,
Hazel called after him, but he didn't answer. Ben drove home with the sun rising in the east, gilding the tops of trees. As they pulled onto their street, he turned to her.
I didn't expect you to do that.
It didn't work, Hazel said.
Tonight,
he said, keeping his voice light and conversational with clear effort.
Kind of got out of control, huh? Everything about it was unexpected.
Yeah, she said, leaning her cheek against the coolness of the window, her hand on the latch of the car door. He pulled the car into their driveway, the tires crunching over gravel.
I'm your older brother, you know? It's not your job to protect me. You can tell me stuff. You can trust me.
You can tell me stuff, too, Hazel said, opening the door and stepping out. She expected him to take the earring out of his pocket and confront her with it, demand an explanation. But he didn't. For all that they'd claimed they could tell each other stuff, they told each other nothing. Hazel walked into the house. It was entirely dark. Even the lights in the outbuilding were off. She began to climb the steps.
Hey, Hazel,
he called softly in the upstairs hall, and she turned.
What did he kiss like?
There was a confusion of emotions on his face, longing and maybe a little jealousy and a whole lot of curiosity. She snorted a surprised laugh, her bad mood dissolving. Like he was a shark and I was blood in the water.
That good?
He asked, grinning. She'd known he'd understand. Brothers and sisters had their own language, their own shorthand. She was glad to be able to share the weird, ridiculous impossibleness of it with the only person who knew all the same stories, with the person who'd made up those stories in the first place. Oh, yeah. Ben went to her, slinging an arm over her shoulder.
Let's get you fixed up.
She let him lead her to the upstairs bathroom, where he sat her on the edge of the tub and then doused all her cuts with peroxide. Together they watched the liquid hiss and froth over her skin before it swirled down the drain. Then, kneeling awkwardly on the cracked beige floor tiles, he wrapped her legs and arms in gauze, the stuff they'd called mummy bandages when they were little. The old phrase rested on the tip of her tongue, making her remember times they'd come in here after a hunt, cleaning their skinned knees and binding up wrists or ankles. The house was usually full of people back then, so it was easy to slip in and out. People were always dropping by, come to pose for a piece, or to borrow some canvas, or celebrate someone booking a job with a bottle of bourbon. Sometimes there wasn't any food but a weird boozy trifle left out on the counter, or a can of cold ravioli, or cheese that smelled like feet. Over the years, her parents grew up and got more normal, even though they wouldn't admit it. Hazel wasn't sure if their memories of those days were as much a blur of people and music and paint and confusion as hers were. She wasn't sure if they missed the way things had been. What she did know was that normal was a lot more tempting when it was out of reach. Once normal had been a heavy, smothering blanket she feared being trapped beneath, but now normal felt fragile, as though she could unravel it all just by teasing out a single string. When Hazel finally collapsed in her bed, she was so tired that she didn't even bother to pull her comforter up over her body. She fell asleep like a flame being extinguished. That morning, Hazel dreamed that she was dressed in a tunic of cream wool with chainmail on top of it. She was riding a horse at night through the woods, fast enough to see only a blur of trees and flashes of hooves pounding ahead of her. Then the leaves seemed to part, and by the light of the full moon, she found herself looking down at humans, kneeling in the dirt, surrounded by milk-white fairy horses. A man, a woman, and a child. The humans were dressed in modern clothes, flannel as though they'd been camping. A tent, slashed and sagging, rested beside a dampened fire.
"Shall they live or shall they die?"
one of the folk asked of his companions. He was speaking carelessly, as though it truly didn't matter either way. His horse snorted and pawed the ground.
"I bet they came out here to glimpse sweet little fairies gathering dewdrops. Surely that's enough reason to cut them down, no matter how they cringe and beg."
"Let us see what talents they possess,"
said another, leaping off his steed, silver hair flying behind him.
"We could let the most amusing one go."
"What say we give the big one ears like a fox?"
shouted a third, a woman with earrings that chimed like the bells on her horse's bridle.
"Give his mate whiskers, or claws like an owl."
"Leave the little one out for the monster,"
said a fourth, making a face at the child.
"Maybe she'll play with it for a while before she gobbles it up."
No. They ventured into the Alder King's woods on a full moon night, and they must have the full measure of his hospitality. Hazel heard herself say as she swung to the ground. Was that her voice? She spoke with such authority. And the humans were looking at her with just as much fear as they'd looked at the others with, as though she were a fairy too. Maybe in her dream she was. "Let us curse them to be rocks until some mortal recognizes their true nature."
"That could take 1,000 years,
said the first one, the careless one, with a lift of one brow. "It could take far longer than that," she heard herself say. "But think of the tales they'd tell if they ever did win freedom." The human man began to cry, pulling his child to his chest. The man looked anguished and betrayed. He must have loved fairy stories to have sought the real thing. He should have read those stories more closely. The silver-haired rider laughed.
"I should like to see other mortals picnic upon them all unknowing. Yes, let's do that. Let's turn them to stone."
One of the humans began to beg, but Hazel looked up at the stars above her and began to count them, instead of listening. Hazel woke, covered by a thin sheen of sweat. Her alarm played tinny music beside her ear. Turning, she shut off her phone and pushed herself out of bed. She should have been disturbed by her dream, but instead it kindled in her a long-forgotten desire for a blade in her hand and sureness of purpose. She'd barely gotten any sleep. She should have been far more exhausted than she felt. Maybe adrenaline was an even better drug than caffeine. After her shower, Hazel got dressed in a loose gray t-shirt and black leggings. She felt stiff and sore. Even the knuckles of her fingers were scraped. As she pulled her hair into a rusty ponytail, memory scattered her thoughts. Flashes of the horned boy, of Severin, kept distracting her. His expressions, the feel of his fingers on her skin, the heat of his mouth. In the bright light of day, it seemed impossible, unreal, but she'd felt the realness of it, all the way down to her traitorous gut. And then her brother, axe held high and shaking hands, face flushed, red hair blowing over his eyes. She hadn't seen Ben like that in years, brave and mad and anguished. She'd been terrified for him, more scared than she'd been during her own stumbling walk through the forest with a horned boy pulling her along. She wondered if that was how Ben had felt all those years ago, when it had been Hazel out in front, blade clutched tight, facing down fairies. Mom was making smoothies in the kitchen when Hazel came downstairs. Kale and ginger, kefir and honey were all lined up on the counter. Mom had on one of Dad's ratty, checkered bathrobes, her short brownish hair sticking up at odd angles, paint still under her fingernails. On the radio, an old song about shiny boots of leather was playing. Ben was sitting on the counter, dressed in rumpled green corduroy pants and a baggy sweater, rubbing his eyes, yawning, and drinking his smoothie out of a quart jar. A tiny square of kale was stuck to his upper lip.
"Morning,"
he said, sounding as though he was still half asleep.
He raised his mason jar in salutation. Hazel grinned. Her mother handed over a mug of coffee.
Ben and I were just talking about the Watkins girl. She got hurt last night a couple of blocks from here. Something about it was just on the radio, along with a warning to stay inside after dark.
Hazel imagined what the emergency services people had seen. Amanda's body, arms folded over her chest, eyes closed, dirt in her mouth, hair spread out like a cape.
What were they saying about her?
Hazel asked dully.
She's in a coma. There's something wrong with her blood. With tonight being a full moon, you both better get home early. Call if you have to be somewhere, okay? I'm going to let your father know, too, in case he decides to drive home sooner than he planned.
Ben pushed off the counter. With his long legs, it was barely any drop at all to the floor.
We'll be careful, he said,
answering what Mom hadn't asked. Mom poured a glass of greenish liquid from the blender and handed it to Hazel.
Don't forget to wear your socks inside out, too, just in case, and put some iron in your pockets. There's a bucket of old nails in the shed. You can grab one from there.
Hazel gulped down her breakfast. It was a little gritty, as though the kale hadn't been quite pulverized enough.
Okay, Mom, Ben rolled his eyes. We know.
Hazel hadn't done any of that stuff, but she appreciated Ben acting as if she had. They went out to the car together. On the drive to school, he looked over at her sleepily.
Later today, you're going to tell me all the parts of last night that I don't know, right?
Hazel sighed. She should have been grateful he was at least giving her some time to figure out how to answer him, but all she felt was dread.
Okay,
she said. Reaching into his pocket, he fished out a necklace with a chip of rowan wood drilled through so that it hung from a chain.
Wear this for me, okay? Mom's not wrong.
Rowan wood. Protection from fairies. All the kids in their school had made pendants like this in kindergarten, along with four-leaf clover pins, and most had hung on to them, or made new ones, to wear every May Eve. Hazel stroked her thumb over it, touched that he'd give her a necklace she was sure he'd made more than a decade before. She lifted her hair and hung it around her throat. Thanks. He didn't say anything else, but he glanced over at her several times, as though he was trying to learn something from her expression, as though he hoped to discover something he hadn't ever thought to look for before. School was strange, hushed, and a little deserted, as though more than a few kids had been kept home by parents. People whispering in the halls, instead of shouting, standing around in knots of close friends. Hazel noticed that lots of them had charms tied around their wrists, or hanging around their throats. Red berries, dried and strung on a silver cord. A gold coin. Herbal oils wafted up off their skin, making the hallway smell not unpleasantly like a head shop. When Hazel began to unpack her bag into her locker, a walnut rolled out, bouncing twice on the linoleum floor. Leaning down to pick it up, she saw that it was tied with rough string. With shaking fingers, she opened it. Another rolled-up piece of paper was inside. She unfurled that to read a new message in the same scratchy hand. Full moon overhead. Better go straight to bed. No way. She wasn't taking orders from some mysterious fairy. Not anymore. Not if she could help it. Crumpling up the note, she tossed it back into her bag. Leonie sauntered up to Hazel's locker, smelling of cigarette smoke. She had on a long, ratty flannel shirt over her white T-shirt with a gold chain around her neck. She'd strung it with a key ring, and in addition to her house keys, it had half a dozen charms hanging from it. Her dark, curly hair was pulled up in two buns on top of her head. They were wet, like she'd put them up right after a shower.
So, she said, I guess you heard, right? About Amanda?
Yeah, Hazel nodded.
Last person to see her was Carter. Everybody's saying one of the Gordon boys had something to do with what happened.
Leonie shrugged to show she wasn't necessarily agreeing, but since she was spreading the rumor, she probably didn't consider them entirely innocent.
I thought whatever happened to her was magical.
A shudder went through Hazel, remembering the dirt in Amanda's mouth and the vines.
Well, that's only one of the Gordon boys, then. And that's the one most people are blaming.
Jack had nothing to do with this.
Thinking of the night before made her recall the shock of Severin's mouth against hers, just 2 days after she had kissed Jack, as though the universe was conspiring to give her everything she'd ever wanted and punishing her at the same time. When her thoughts returned to Amanda, lying in the ditch, she felt even worse about the kisses.
Well, it's all just a rumor,
Leonie said airily. It's not like I believe it or anything.
Well, it's crazy, and you shouldn't be repeating it.
This shit is crazy, Leonie said. This is not normal Fairfold weird, not tourist weird. It's actually fucked up and not okay weird. Amanda's family's always lived here. She's supposed to be protected. People are freaking out, and I am repeating the rumor because I thought you'd want to know. I'm not broadcasting it all over school.
Hazel took a few calming breaths. Snapping at Leonie wasn't helping anything.
Sorry. It's just that none of the stuff that goes on in the woods is okay. Not the tourist stuff, not any of it, and I don't see what Amanda's being unconscious has to do with Jack at all.
Well, I think it comes from two facts. Firstly, Jack's one of them. And secondly, Amanda broke Jack's heart, which is tragic because it means that even a supernatural hottie has the same generic taste as every other idiot in this school. I think he liked her even more than he used to like you, and that's saying something, but it does give him a motive. Hazel rolled her eyes.
Me? You must be thinking of someone else. Jack Gordon was never into me.
Leonie shook her head.
Whatever. The point is, he's not human, and people know it. Remember when he broke Matt's nose?
I guess, Hazel said, slamming her locker shut. She was having difficulty with the whole stay-in-calm thing. Matt is supernaturally annoying, if that's your point.
The bell rang, and they both started down the hallway in the direction of their first period classes. They had about 5 minutes before the second bell. Hazel wondered if Jack or Carter knew about the rumors. If they did, she hoped they stayed home from school until all this blew over. Everyone was just scared, that was all, and Jack made a convenient target. No one would ever believe Carter had anything to do with this, not for long. And they'd get over thinking it was Jack, too, just as soon as they thought things through. At least Hazel hoped they would.
I was there, Leonie said. The fight with Matt got weird. The kind of weird that people remember.
Matt Yasko was about 3 years older than Hazel and Leonie, handsome, with jet black hair and a constant sneer. Matt had been Leonie's worst habit, worse than cigarettes or weed, worse than any wastrel any of the rest of them had ever dated. He'd been the kind of cruel that insinuated itself into your head, making you doubt yourself, and Hazel had hated him. He was one of the few cute boys in town she'd never even considered kissing. Despite being so awful, when he moved away for college, Leonie had cried for a week straight.
"Weird how?" Hazel asked.
They were standing in front of her American history room, but she wasn't ready to go inside. Her heart was racing. It felt as though Severin's being released from his casket had been the first domino to fall, but she still didn't know the pattern its falling produced. And if Severin wasn't the first domino, then she knew even less.
Jack didn't punch Matt.
Leonie glanced to one side as if she was afraid of being overheard.
Matt was being his usual awful self. Then Jack, well, Jack smiled this really weird smile, leaned over, and whispered in his ear. The next thing we knew, Matt was hitting himself.
Like, really going to town, slamming his fist into his own face until his lip was cut and blood was streaming from his nose. Hazel had no idea what to say to that.
How come you never said anything? I don't know.
Later, Matt seemed to remember it like it was a fist fight, so I just went along with that. It seemed easier. Other people were there, though. And even if they didn't say anything before, they're going to talk now. And that can't be the only time Jack slipped up. There's stuff about him that he's not exactly forthcoming about, I guess, is all I'm saying. He has secrets. He can do things.
The bell went off, making Hazel jolt.
I should have told you before,
Leonie said softly.
Ms. Evans, Mr. DeCampo, her balding teacher, called. Standing directly outside my door and gossiping with your friend is not the same as being in class, so I suggest that you get to your desk immediately. Ms. Wallace, you are beyond late. I suggest that you run.
You're a good friend,
Hazel told Leonie.
I know,
Leonie said, making a face in Mr. DeCampo's direction.
See you at lunch.
At her desk, Hazel opened a notebook, but instead of taking notes on the major domestic issues of the Federalist era, Hazel began to list what she knew. She liked lists. They were comfortingly straightforward, even when they were full of crazy stuff, like warnings. 7 years to pay your debts, much too late for regrets. Ainsel. Name of fairy enchanting me? The weird story about the farmer tricking the Bogart. Full moon overhead, better go straight to bed. Other info. Jack has magic, he's hiding. Severin is loose and super scary. I'm the one who freed him. Even scarier monster is hunting for Severin and maybe put Amanda into an enchanted sleep. Severin knows all the stuff we said in front of him. Someone, the Alder King, because of bargain, is making me do stuff I don't remember after I go to sleep. Or did at least once. Severin needs a magic sword called Heart Something for unknown and possibly sinister reasons. To kill the thing that put Amanda to sleep? To fight back against the Alder King? To kill us all? My old sword is gone. Same sword? Then she stopped. The idea that the sword she'd found all those years ago was the one he'd been looking for had occurred to her before, but she hadn't really let herself dwell on it. If so, either someone took the sword or she'd handed it over to someone. Maybe to the person who'd left her the notes. Maybe the mysterious Ainsel? Had she made a second bargain with the folk? One that she could no longer recall? Was her forgetting part of the condition of the bargain? She pressed her pen against the page so hard that the shaft started to bend. She needed answers. To get them, she needed to find someone with more information, which, unfortunately, meant one of the folk. She thought of her dream from the night before, and of the full moon that was going to rise that night, which meant a revel. Maybe Jack, with all his secrets, would know the way there. And then all she had to do was survive the revel, get the information, make a plan, and then survive the plan. No problem. She shifted on the hard plastic chair of her desk, figuring out what she could say to Jack to persuade him to tell her about the revel. After class, she waited at his locker, but he didn't show. And when she went by his next period class, he wasn't there. She was too distracted to take a single note. And when she was called on in language arts, she gave the answer to a trigonometry question from the period before, making everyone laugh. It took Hazel until just before lunch to find him. Jack was walking down the hall with Carter. She wasn't close enough to hear much of what he was saying, but Carter sounded angry. She caught the words, "with me last," and "suspect." Jack was hunched over, looking exhausted. There was a purpling bruise coming up along his cheekbone. She wondered how much today had already sucked for him. She wondered how much worse she was about to make it. Jack! Hazel called before she could lose her nerve. He turned and his smile was real enough that she felt somewhat better. At least until she saw how red and watery his eyes were, as though irritated by all the charms and oils because any protection from fairies must work against him. Then she saw how raw Carter's knuckles looked. Blood was drying across them. There must have been a fight.
"Can I talk to you for a second?"
she asked, weaving her way to Jack through the tide of the hallway. Carter gave him a playful shove in Hazel's direction.
"Go on, then. Don't keep the girl waiting."
Hazel wondered what she'd done to get on Carter's good side. Jack looked a little embarrassed.
"Yeah, sure, whatever."
They matched their steps to each other's. He had on a striped cardigan over a worn Afropunk festival t-shirt. Heavy silver hoops shone in his ears. He tried to hold on to the smile for her, but it sat in odd contrast to the rest of his expression.
"You okay?"
she asked,
clutching her books to her chest. He sighed.
I just wish Carter didn't have to deal with this. You probably heard it all already, but just in case, he didn't do anything to her.
Hazel started to protest that she already knew that. He shook his head.
And I didn't either. I swear it, Hazel.
Listen, she interrupted. I really do know it wasn't him.
Or you.
I saw Amanda last night with the horned boy.
What?
His brows went up, and he stopped looking eager to convince her of Carter's innocence.
How?
I told the police, but I don't know if it matters, she said. And I'm sorry to have to ask you this on top of everything else, but I need to know where the folk hold their full moon revel. Can you help me?
That's what you wanted to talk to me about?
Jack asked her, his expression becoming remote.
That's why you stopped me in the hall?
I really need to know.
Yes,
he said softly.
I know where it's held.
She soldiered on.
Have you been there?
Hazel,
he said, cautioning her. Please, she said. One way or another, I'm going to go. Jack tilted his head in a way that made her newly aware of how the planes of his face weren't quite like Carter's, of how his cheekbones were higher, his face longer. And she was aware, too, of the subtle points at the tips of his ears. For a moment, as when he delivered the warning to her and Ben, his familiar face was made strange. She thought of Leone's story about him whispering in Matt's ear, about Matt slamming his own fist into his own face over and over again.
I've got to get to class.
He started to walk away, then seemed to feel bad about it, and turned back to her.
I'm sorry.
She grabbed hold of his arm.
Jack, she said, please.
He shook his head without looking at her.
Did you know there are different names for different moons? This month it's going to be the Hunter's Moon. But March has the Worm Moon and the Crow Moon. May has the Milk Moon. July the Mead Moon. February has the Hunger Moon. And late October, the Blood Moon. Aren't they lovely names? Aren't they something, Hazel? Aren't they warning enough?
How many times have you been there? She asked in a whisper. If Jack's mother even suspected, it would break her heart.
Lots,
he said, finally, in a strangled voice. I'm going with you, she said. We're going together tonight to the Blood Moon, or the Hunter's Moon, or whatever name you want to call it. The Head-Chopping Moon, for all I care. Jack shook his head.
It's not safe for you.
Did you not just hear me say, I don't care, Hazel said. Someone is using me... And I need to know who and why, and you need to clear Carter's name, and yours too. We need to know what's really going on.
Do not ask me for this,
Jack said, with odd formality. Hazel wondered if he was worried about betraying his other family. She wondered if his Fairfold was a Fairfold that Hazel couldn't even imagine. I'm not asking, she told him as firmly as she could. I'm going. Even if I'm going alone, he nodded once, inhaling shakily.
After school. I'll meet you on the kids' playground.
Then he turned and sped off down the hall. A few stray students, late to class or sporting hall passes, slid away from him as though he were contagious. Chapter 11 Changelings are fish you're supposed to throw back. A cuckoo raised by sparrows. They don't quite fit anywhere. Jack grew up knowing he was strange, without at first knowing why. He wasn't adopted, he could see that. He looked just like his brother, Carter. He had the same dark skin as his mother, and the same tight brown curls, and the same slightly too long first toes. But something was wrong. He might have his father's amber eyes, and his father's chin. But that didn't seem to stop Dad from glancing at him with a worried, nervous expression, an expression that said, "You're not what you seem." His mother rubbed him with coconut oil after his bath and sang him songs. His grandmother held him and told him stories. There was a village near the Ebo River, one story began. A story passed down to his grandmother from her Yoruban ancestors. In it, a woman named Bola had a son who grew too large to carry on her back to the market, so Bola waited until he was sleeping and went without him
latching the door behind her. When she returned, he was still asleep, but all the food in the house was gone. She wondered whether someone could have snuck into the house, but the door had not been forced, and nothing but the food was missing. Soon after, a neighbor came to Bola and asked her to repay a string of cowrie shells. Bola hadn't borrowed money from her neighbor and told her as much, but the woman insisted, explaining that Bola's son had come to her house saying that he was on an errand for his mother, who needed the cowries to buy more food. Bola shook her head and brought the neighbor into her house. The child was napping on a woven mat. "See," she said. "My baby is very little, far too small to walk and talk. How could he have come to your door? How could he have asked to borrow cowries?" The neighbor stared in confusion. She explained that the boy who'd come to her door looked much like the sleeping child, but was far older. When Bola heard this, she became greatly distressed. She didn't doubt her neighbor and believed that her child must have been possessed by an evil spirit. When Bola's husband came home that night, she told him everything, and he became troubled as well. Together they made a plan. Her husband hid himself in the house while Bola went to the market, leaving the baby sleeping behind a latch door, just as before. Her husband watched as the child stood, his body stretching as he grew to the size of a 10-year-old. Then he began eating. He ate yams, locust beans, ripe mangoes, pawpaw, and savory plantains, washing it all down with water from a calabash. He ate and ate and ate. Finally, his father, recovering from the shock of what he'd witnessed, stepped from his hiding place and called the child's name. At the sound of his father's voice, the boy shrank down to a baby again. In this way, Bola and her husband determined that their child was, indeed, possessed by a spirit. They beat the child with rushes to drive the spirit out. Finally, it fled, leaving them with their own sweet baby again. Jack hated that story, but it didn't stop his grandmother from telling it. Years later, when Jack heard how he had come to be part of the family, he remembered the folktale and understood the reason his father looked at him the way he did. He was neither his father's son nor his mother's, nor chosen by the family. He'd been foisted on them. He was wearing borrowed skin, watching them with borrowed eyes, and living with them in the life he'd almost stolen from Carter. And like Bola's child, Jack was always hungry. He ate and ate and ate, fresh cheese and loaves of bread, jars of peanut butter and gallons of milk. Sometimes when one of his parents took him to the grocery store, he would swallow a dozen eggs behind a turned back. They would slide down his throat, shells and all, filling up the aching emptiness inside him. He picked sour apples off the summer trees and gulped down cotton balls soaked in water when he was too embarrassed to ask for a fifth helping of dinner. The first time he met Hazel Evans, he thought that she might be a creature like him. She looked wild enough, her hair clumped with mud and face smeared with berry juice, running through the woods in bare feet, sword strapped to her back. Ben Evans had come running behind her, nearly as wild. They stopped short at the sight of him. "What are you doing?" he asked. "Hunting monsters," Ben said. "Seen any?"
"How do you know I'm not one?" Jack asked them.
"Don't be stupid," Hazel said. "If you were a monster, you'd know it." Jack wasn't so sure. But they'd shown him how to find blackberries and how to make a sandwich of dandelion leaves, wild onions, and fiddlehead ferns. More than anyone he'd ever known, Hazel was herself. Not scared of anything. Not scared of him. And Ben understood about having magic. He understood all the ways that magic sucked. Which was one of the reasons Ben was an awesome friend. They got tight after he came back from Philadelphia, in part because they made a pact to tell each other all the stuff they couldn't tell anyone else. Ben confessed that his music alternately tempted and terrified him. He told Jack stories about the ways his parents were screw-ups. In turn, Jack told Ben about the magic sparking inside him and how hard it was to hide sometimes. He told Ben about the hunger and the loneliness.
"So the riders came again?" Ben asked one afternoon, after a full moon night.
They were walking home from school, past
past the glass coffin where Ben would go on his lunch breaks to talk with the sleeping prince. Jack thought about teasing him, but Ben's crush on the horned boy was only slightly more ridiculous than Jack's own crush. He nodded, torn.
"Does your mom suspect?"
Jack shrugged.
"She never says anything, but she's always rubbing the lintels with St. John's wort to keep the folk out, or me in. Hangs a garland of marigolds over the doors on May Eve."
"That sucks," Ben said, looking up at the sky.
"But it sounds like it could just be her standard operating procedure. If she knew, she'd say something, wouldn't she?"
"Maybe. Just the other day, she made Carter carry dried holly berries in the pocket of his jacket. He got mad and chucked one at me. They sting like a bitch." Ben winced.
"I bet."
Jack remembered the way his skin had hurt for an hour after, as if from a spider bite. Fairfold was full of protections. People wore them around their necks, smeared them on their doors, hung them from the rearview mirrors of their cars. The stupid St. John's wort made him itch. So did cold-shaped iron when it was near him, although it burned where it actually touched his skin. Pockets full of oatmeal or grave dirt made him sneeze. Some amulets made his head hurt, others made his head swim. None of it was deadly, not just from being close by, but the constant discomfort was a reminder of how little he belonged among the people of the town. Jack picked up a dried-out stick, turning it in his hand.
It would almost be better if she did know.
They'd come for the first time 2 months before, on a full moon. Three of them, dressed in silvery gray, on three horses, one black, one white, and the third red. Jack had woken from a sound sleep to music. Music that made him feel an intense longing for the forest and the wind in his face and the casting off of mortal things. When he went to the window, he saw them on the lawn, riding around the house, eyes flashing, hair streaming like pennants. Seven times they circled, and then the riders paused, looking up as though they'd spotted him in the window. They were achingly beautiful and absolutely terrifying, black-eyed and red-mouthed. One wore a face familiar enough that it seemed to him that this must be a dream. He knew without any speech that they wanted him to follow. He shook his head, staying where he was, framed by the window, fingernails digging into the wood. After a few moments, they turned one by one and rode off. In the morning, when Jack woke, the window had been thrown wide despite his mother's anointing of the lintel. Leaves were scattered all around his room.
"Creepy riders are creepy," Ben said.
"Yeah, creepy," Jack echoed. But even to his own ears, he didn't sound sincere.
"You're not going away with them next time, are you?"
Ben asked, voice teasing.
"Shut up."
Jack chucked the stick at Ben, but he ducked and it flew past him. Ben stopped walking and stopped smirking, too.
"Wait, you are?
You don't understand what they were like, how I felt. You can't understand."
Jack spat out the words before he considered them, unwilling to tell Ben that he had gone that last time. He'd regretted not riding alongside them ever since they'd come on the first full moon night. When he refused them a second time, it nearly broke his heart. The third time, he was helpless to resist the call. He went, and after, he feared he could not summon up the strength to resist them again. Maybe Ben saw something of what Jack felt in his expression because he grew serious.
"Sometimes I wonder about Kerem," he said. "I worry that the music made him like me. And even knowing that doesn't keep me from wanting to play again. That's why I broke my hand, otherwise I'd play. Every time I wanted something bad enough, I'd play."
Jack blinked, shocked.
"How come you never said that before?"
Ben snorted.
"Saving it for a special occasion, I guess. A special occasion where I could make you feel less crappy by telling you something awful about myself. But if you don't want to go with them, you're going to have to lash yourself to the bed like sailors who lash themselves to masts to avoid jumping into the sea with sirens." Ben might have understood more than Jack had thought. But he still couldn't possibly have known what it was like to ride with them through the night or plunge into a moonlit pool. He couldn't have understood what it felt like to dance until the force of his steps seemed to crack open the earth itself, to be among creatures who had never been human and could never be human, to be one of them. And Ben couldn't have known the shame that Jack felt after when, sweat cooling on his skin, he promised himself that when they came for him the next time, he wouldn't go. A promise that he'd never keep.
Chapter 12. Instead of going to lunch, Hazel went to the bathroom to splash water on her face, studying her freckles in the mirror, looking past eyeliner and eyeshadow to the blue of her iris. She hoped to see someone who knew what she was doing staring back. Someone she could believe would get her out of this. No such luck. Jack might take her to the revel, but once there, she was going to need to figure out the right questions to ask. The ones that would make them think she knew more than she did. The ones they would answer without knowing they were giving anything away. The girl in the mirror didn't look like a master of deception, though. She looked as if she was already in over her head. If she couldn't trick them, then it would be good if she had something to trade. Because with the folk, nothing was ever free. If she'd been Ben, she could have played a song for them, and even broken-fingered, she would have been so good that they would have granted her any boon. If she'd been like Jack, they would have told her stuff because she was one of them. But she was Hazel. She had no magic, which meant she needed to be on her toes, thinking fast and paying attention to everything. With a sigh, she took one of the paper towels from the dispenser, wiped her face, and went into the hall. A freshman boy came around the corner so fast he nearly knocked into her. His face was wet. Lourdes's little brother, Michael, she thought that was his name. Tears streamed over his blotchy cheeks. A choking sound came from his throat. "What's wrong?" she asked. "Did something happen?"
"I can't,"
he managed through the tears and ragged breaths, wiping at his face furiously.
"I can't stop. She's coming. She's almost here."
That's when she heard it. Sounds of crying coming from inside the classrooms around her, thin wails that rose to shrieks. The door to a classroom to Hazel's right flew open, and seniors flooded into the hall, eyes wild with terror and wet with tears. Megan Rojas fell to her knees and began to tear at her clothes in an orgy of grief.
"Please,"
Franklin sobbed, turning his face to Hazel, his anguish so raw she barely recognized him.
"Please make it stop. Kiss me, make it stop."
Abruptly, she remembered Jack's warning. Something even more dangerous than your prince walks in his shadow. Hazel backed away from Franklin, from his terrified, upturned face. There was a scent in the air like turned leaf mold and vegetal rot.
"It's so sad,"
Liz was saying over and over, words muffled by tears.
"So sad. So very, very sad."
Hazel had to do something. She had to find Ben before whatever was happening to them happened to him. She started to run, past lockers and closed doors, turning a corner into the art room hallway. Light streamed in from a bank of windows facing a grass-covered courtyard. One of the freshman language arts teachers was locking a door. A burst of laughter came from another classroom. It was as though she hadn't just come from a hallway full of weeping students.
"Did you come from some kind of assembly?" Ms. Nelson asked. "I heard a lot of noise."
Hazel began to speak, stammering over words, when, above their heads, a loudspeaker crackled to life. Someone on the other end seemed to be crying. The sound of it stuck in Hazel's head like taffy. Miss Nelson looked puzzled.
"Someone must have hit the button in the office without realizing it."
Hazel could hear the weeping in the liquid drum of her heart. In her every breath, it pricked the back of her eyes. It was so much, so sad, as though all the sorrow she'd ever felt woke in her at once. Ms. Nelson stumbled, her hand going to the glass. Her breath hit the window, fogging it. her eyes filled with tears. And then Hazel noticed blotches of something greenish, like mold or moss, creeping across the glass. Outside, black crows began landing on the branches of a tree, cawing to one another.
"We've got to get out of here," Hazel whispered in a tear-slurred voice.
She stumbled away and heard a body hit the floor, heard the sound of soft, muffled weeping.
Hazel had to think. Her eyes were already filled with hot tears, her throat already thick with them, and everything she'd ever lost was crowding her head. She remembered looking down at Adam Hicks's half-rotted body and feeling utterly helpless. She thought of being sick during one of her parents' parties, having eaten a big chunk of cake before she realized it had been soaked in rum. Dizzy, she'd looked for her mother, but everyone had seemed to be a stranger. She'd thrown up in the bathroom for what felt like hours until some of her throw-up was streaked with blood and a man she didn't know brought her a glass of water from the tap. Hazel thought of that night and other nights, thought of her brother's broken fingers, of the way his nails blackened and fell off one by one, of all the boys she'd kissed, and how the names she remembered first were of the ones who'd hated her after, because she remembered things that hurt more easily than anything nice. Hazel wanted to lie down on the sticky linoleum floor, curl up, weep forever, and never rise again. It seemed pointless not to give in, to keep standing. But she kept standing anyway. It seemed pointless to cross the hall, but she crossed the hall anyway. "Go over there and pull the fire alarm," she told herself. She didn't think she could. "You don't have to believe you can," she told herself. "Just do it." The sound of weeping grew louder, nearly crowding out all other thoughts. Her fingers closed on the red metal lever. Throwing her weight against it, she brought it down hard. Immediately, the alarm sounded louder than the crying, louder than the keening and the shrieking and the cawing of crows. Hazel's head pounded, but she could think again. After a moment, students started shuffling out of classrooms. Their cheeks were wet, eyes red-rimmed, and faces ashen. Normally, the hall would ring with shouting, with gossip, with friends calling to one another. Right then, it was as quiet as a procession of the dead.
"Liz?"
The industrial arts teacher came over, crouching near Ms. Nelson's body.
"Evans, what happened out here? What's happening?"
"I don't know,"
Hazel said, looking up at the loudspeaker. Moss was spreading up the wall in patches, thickening like fur. If it kept growing like that, it would eventually smother the alarm. He blinked at her as if he hadn't quite processed what he was seeing yet, as if he was still making up excuses in his head. Ms. Nelson blinked and started to push herself up.
"What's going on?"
she asked, voice hoarse.
"Is that the fire alarm?"
The shop teacher nodded.
"Some kind of emergency. Come on, let's get you outside."
A tiny crack started in one corner of the wall. Hazel watched it spread, watched it split into two cracks as vines seeped through.
"There's a fire?"
a sophomore boy with a shaved head asked, coming from another hall in gym clothes.
"Outside,"
commanded the shop teacher, pointing toward the exit.
"You too, Evans."
Hazel nodded, but she wasn't ready to move. She was still staring at the moss and at the looping pale vines poking through the growing fissures like fingers pushing free from a grave. Students flooded around her, on their way to line up outside, on their way to wait for the fire department to declare this a false alarm, maybe a prank. Hazel leaned against the windows, taking several shaky breaths. That was when she saw Molly coming down the hallway, moving against the stream of bodies. She was walking strangely, as if she was half dragging herself along, as if her limbs had become unfamiliar to her. Her expression was blank. Her gaze seemed to slide over everything until it fell on Hazel. Molly's lips looked blue at first, but the more Hazel stared at them, the more she realized they were stained green, stained from the inside, as though she had been eating sour apple Laffy Taffy. Hazel stayed still, a hideous chill starting at the base of her spine. She'd been scared when she saw the other kids crying, but the revulsion she felt at the way Molly moved was entirely new.
Hazel knew that she might be looking at Molly's body, but Molly was no longer looking out through her eyes.
"Stay back," Hazel said, as whatever it was got close, throwing up a hand automatically, stopping just short of knocking the girl to the floor.
A syrup-sweet voice came from Molly's mouth, speaking in sing-song. Her head tilted to one side.
"I loved him, and he's dead and gone and bones. I loved him, and they took him away from me. Where is he? Where is he? Dead and gone and bones. Dead and gone and bones. Where is he?"
With every word, clumps of dirt fell from her tongue.
"What are you doing to Molly?" Hazel asked shakily.
The hall was nearly empty. The alarm was still ringing, but somehow the voice coming from Molly's mouth carried easily over the sound.
"I loved him, and I loved him, and he's dead and gone and bones. I loved him, and they took him away from me. Where is he? Where is he? Dead and gone and bones. Dead and gone and bones. My father took him. My brother killed him. Dead and gone and bones. Dead and gone and bones. Where is he?"
Molly had been Hazel's best friend for 2 years, the one she'd stayed up late, instant messaging about boys, the one she'd trusted to trim her bangs. When she and Molly walked through the halls, Hazel had felt like there was nothing wrong with normal, as if maybe she could just focus on having fun and not worrying too much about what came after. Molly didn't care about fairies in the woods, they were just stories to her. She thought that all the tourist stuff was a scam, and that the tourists themselves were boring, desperate for someone to tell them they were special. Seeing Fairfold through Molly's eyes was like seeing an entirely new place. After Molly dumped her, Hazel sometimes thought she missed seeing the world that way, even more than she missed Molly. Now Molly would have no choice but to believe in the folk. The thought made Hazel furious.
"You can't have her," Hazel said, fumbling for her necklace, the one Ben had made her wear. She pulled the chain strung with rowan wood from around her throat. When the creature didn't react, Hazel thrust it over Molly's head, letting the amulet settle at Molly's throat.
"See? So go! Go! You're not welcome here!"
Abruptly, Molly's eyes rolled upward until Hazel saw only the white of her sclera. Hazel's heart thundered. Then Molly collapsed to the floor, her whole body going limp at once. Her head hit the linoleum, making a horrible, hollow sound.
"Help!"
Hazel called. She knelt down, fumbling for Molly's wrist, meaning to take her pulse before she realized she had no idea how to do that. Over and over she screamed the word, and over, nobody came. Then Molly opened her eyes, blinking wildly, coughing so hard it was half choking. When she looked at Hazel, the expression that washed over her face was some commingling of embarrassment and terror. It was an entirely human expression.
"Hazel,"
Molly croaked, spitting out dirt and what appeared to be leaves. Sweet, incredulous relief made Hazel lean against the wall.
"You're okay?"
Molly nodded slowly, pushing herself into a half-sitting position, wiping at her chin. Her black hair, usually gelled into spiky precision, was a mess. Blood dribbled from a shallow cut where her head had struck the floor, turning the collar of her white shirt red.
"I saw it. The monster. It's made of old knotted branches grown over with moss, and it has these horrible black eyes."
Hazel scooted closer and reached out to take Molly's hand. Molly squeezed hard. The alarm was still going, a siren wailing into the emptiness of the halls.
"You always knew this was all real, didn't you?"
she asked, anguished.
"How can you stand it?"
Hazel was trying to formulate a reply, when Molly's eyes closed, she shuddered once and collapsed like a marionette with its strings cut. Hazel shouted and shook her by her shoulders, but Molly's body was as limp as Amanda's had been. The monster was no longer content to wait in the heart of the forest. It had come to the center of Fairfold in the middle of the day, and Hazel wasn't sure if it could even be slain. Whether it had come for Severin, because someone had summoned it, or for a reason beyond Hazel's comprehension, she had to focus. She needed to get out of that hallway, and she needed to get Molly out, too. Carrying Molly over her shoulders would be possible, but not ideal. Hazel wouldn't be able to fight, and she wouldn't be able to move fast, either.
"Stay right there," Hazel said to Molly softly as she got up.
She passed the widening crack in the wall, from which tendrils of ivy spilled into the room like snakes, and she went down the hall toward the art room just as two people came barreling around the corner. It was Carter, with a phone in one hand and a hockey stick in the other. Robbie Delmonico was beside him, brandishing a baseball bat. He yelped at the sight of her, stumbling back into a bank of lockers, making them rattle like chains. Hazel found her hands balled into loose fists.
"What the hell?"
"Relax. We were looking for you,"
Carter said. He was wearing the rib pad from his football uniform and knee plates. Hazel had never before noticed how much football gear was like armor. With his broad shoulders and excellent jawline, he looked like Sir Morian from the Round Table.
"Emergency services people won't let anyone back into the school. Ben and Jack got stuck out in the parking lot, so they've been lecturing me over texts on where you might go."
He gestured vaguely toward the front of the school.
"There's some kind of thing,"
Robbie put in.
"We found three freshmen under one of the tables in the cafeteria. They were out cold, or at least I thought they were, but one of them opened her eyes and told me something super creepy, something about bones. Then she passed out again. We carried them to some EMTs through an open window, but figured we'd stay inside until we were sure everyone else got out."
Hazel nodded. She was forcibly reminded what a good guy Robbie was and why she'd kissed him in the first place, before things had gotten weird. The hardest thing about being wanted was the hardest thing about wanting. Wanting badly enough that it gave you a stomach ache. Wanting in the way that it was partly about kissing and partly about swallowing whole, the way a snake gulps down a mouse or the big bad wolf gulps down Red Riding Hood. Wanting turned someone you felt like you knew into a stranger. Whether that person was your brother's best friend or a sleeping prince in a glass prison or a girl who kissed you at a party. The moment you wanted more than just touching your mouth to theirs, they became terrifying, and you became terrified.
"Dead and gone and bones," she said.
He lifted his bat higher, eyes widening.
"Not you too."
Hazel shook her head, sighing.
"Molly said that before she passed out. She was, I don't know, possessed or something like it."
"Molly Lipscomb?"
Carter looked past Hazel down the hallway and stiffened at the sight of Molly's body.
"Did you see the monster? Was it here?"
Hazel shook her head.
"We've got to move her, though. I'm getting a chair."
She turned to Robbie.
"Try to find rope or yarn or something we can tie her with."
"Yeah, okay."
Robbie nodded, starting toward one of the classrooms.
"Jack says..."
Carter seemed to realize he was talking to himself more than them and bit off the thought with a shake of his head.
"I'll stay by Molly. You guys get whatever you think you need."
Hazel found a swivel chair behind the teacher's desk in the second classroom she entered and rolled it into the hall while Robbie managed to discover a spool of heavy bright blue string in one of the closets. Hazel lifted Molly while Robbie braced the chair so her weight didn't send it flying suddenly backward. Then Carter helped them tie her in place as if she were a prisoner about to be interrogated or a fly stuck in a spider's web. Head lolling to one side, eyes shut, Molly was soon held fast to the chair by layers and layers of crisscrossed string. Then Hazel went back for a weapon. She found a pair of heavy scissors in the desk and slammed them down until the two pieces came apart, and she had made herself twin daggers.
"Jesus, that was loud,"
Carter said, hands on the back of Molly's chair.
"Come on."
They walked down the empty hall together, peering into abandoned classrooms, where jackets were still draped over the backs of chairs and desks still had papers and pens and books lying on them. Whiteboards had been left with math problems half solved, carried ones floating above unadded numerals. A documentary about genetics still played on a projection screen.
A few desks in the back of one room were entirely covered in a spreading tide of moss. The shadows lengthened as they made their way past the gymnasium. Hazel stepped in, her scissors gleaming in the flicker.